Blog Talk Radio.
Is this
Blog Talk Radio?
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us again today on Human Rights Demand. This is the Bob Darby show, and he is an advocate for the homeless mentally ill. And we so much appreciate your attention today as we bring to you important information regarding the homeless mentally ill. Bob Darby, are you with me?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today on your show where you present the case for the homeless mentally ill. Bob Darby, how long have you been an advocate for the homeless mentally ill?
For about 20 years. That's about 1994.
Wonderful. And give us a little bit about your background and then get into your show. I happen to have read information about the task force in Atlanta in their lawsuit. And I wonder if you are abreast of that, or should I pull up the article?
Well, please pull up the article. If you have a current article, you're more abreast of the information than I am. I do know that
I'll look for that while you tell us about yourself and about the current situation regarding homelessness in our area, and we live in the metro Atlanta, Georgia area, and also the overall situation of homelessness in the United States of America. So a little background about you and what you what your background is regarding advocacy for the homeless mentally ill, and a little information about the situation here in Atlanta and in the nation, and I'll be looking for that article for you, okay?
Okay.
Sure. Okay, well, I'm a 69-year-old man who is presently retired from gainful employment, frankly living on Social Security benefits. And I spend much of my time advocating for the homeless and the incarcerated mentally ill.
Sure.
I have a bachelor's degree in psychology from Emory University from 1967, and much of my working life was involved in working in hospitals and our counseling and attendant positions in several different hospitals, Boston State Hospital, Dartmouth Hanover Hospital in New Hampshire, and Georgia Regional Hospital in Atlanta. So I spent many years working in mental hospitals. And what has happened with the hospital system is that since the late 70s and early 80s, really, when Ronald Reagan became president, the process that they call deinstitutionalization, that's the mental health system, has taken place, has been set in effect, which really means shutting down your hospitals and throwing sick people out on the street.
It
doesn't mean anything
new,
because what is supposedly to be taking the place of the hospitals, the outpatient therapy system, is really not being instituted. So when people get sick from mental illness, and there are several different types, they often have nowhere to turn because of the poverty and the lack of public mental health facilities. There are, according to the New York Times, there are three times as many mental ill people housed in prisons and jails than in hospitals. And in 1955, there was one bed in the psychiatric ward for every 300 Americans, and now there is one for every 3,000 Americans. The problem is great because the presence of mental illness in the human community has always been great. Mental disorders, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, are very common. An estimated 26.2% of Americans age 18 and older, which is about 1 in 4 adults, suffers from a diagnosable mental disorder in a given year. The main burden of the illness is concentrated in a smaller population, about 6%, or 1 in 17, who suffer from a serious mental illness. So we're talking about many millions of people. If we take in the United States just the people who are suffering from what is regarded as the most severe mental illnesses, namely schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, there are about 9 million Americans over 18. That's just the adult population. About 9 million Americans who suffer from schizophrenia and bipolar. These, about 20% are homeless, according to a study done by the University of California in 2006. So we're talking about a couple of million people at least living on the streets with severe mental illness in the United States. Nobody really knows the exact number of people who are homeless, but don't believe what you read when you first look into the Google it or do some research where they say that less than a million people are homeless. They are cooking the statistics because they're counting people who are unsheltered on the streets. If you count people who are homeless but sheltered in prison, who are hiding from being counted, who deny that they're homeless when in fact they're homeless, the number of the homeless is certainly in the millions. I think there's probably 3 to 5 million homeless in the United States. And that includes the categories I was just talking about. It's not just unsheltered homeless people. It's people living in shelters, people who are in jail or prison, usually on petty offenses like urinating in public and vagrancy or aggressive panhandling. What has happened is that with the process of deinstitutionalization, hospitals have been shut down all over the United States, and the people released from the hospitals have had nowhere to go but to homelessness if their families and friends were unable to take care of them, or if they were unable to get stabilized on the very expensive medications that are available or get help. But anyway, it's a dreadful situation. In the state of Georgia, in the last 5 years or so, quite a few hospitals have shut down. The adult care unit of the Central State Hospital in Milledgeville, which was the largest capacity of all the hospitals in Georgia, the adult care unit shut down. So now they only have a juvenile facility and a forensic facility. The hospitals in Rome, Georgia, and Southwest Georgia, and Thomasville have been completely shut down. And number of hospital beds in the Georgia Regional Hospital in Atlanta and the Columbus Hospital in West Georgia have not been expanded to keep up with the population in the last 20, 30 years. So there are only 260 adult care beds to care for the public in Atlanta, public hospitals. That means that there are only 260 beds to take care of the population of over 4 million people in metro Atlanta. So that's why we have so many homeless people, about a third or probably more than a third, depending on whose estimates you believe, of all the homeless are diagnosably severely mentally ill. So they end up on the streets and very, very oftentimes they end up in prison and jail. The percentage of people who are mentally ill in prison and jail is somewhere between 30% and 40%. And prisons and jails are three times as likely, as I said earlier, mentally ill people are three times as likely to be housed in prisons and jails than in hospitals. So what has occurred with deinstitutionalization, which was seriously initiated under the administration of Ronald Reagan and starting in 1981, what has happened has been the wholesale abandonment of millions of people to the streets, and those people in the streets have very often ended up being housed in prisons and jails. So I include the people who are mentally ill in prisons and jails as among the homeless, and when we do that, we're talking about 3 to 5 million homeless people living on the streets or in jails in the United States. So It's a dreadful situation, and it's coupled with the fact that shelters are being shut down, just homeless shelters in Atlanta. Just recently this year, I mean, in fact, the last recent months, Jefferson Street Men's Shelter, which housed 185 men, has been shut down. And the women's shelter, Springdale, is scheduled to be shut down in October. So they're shutting down shelters. They're expanding jail facilities. And this country is turning into a virtual police state. And that's the overall position that I have that I wanted to share with you and that I talk about every time I go on the air. And Mary, are you ready to respond? Do you have anything to say? Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am here, Bob Darby. And we are, first of all, want to give you our thanks for bringing us this information regarding the situation that exists throughout America in relation to the mentally ill homeless. You did an excellent job in covering how it came about. And it is truly an epidemic. We have an epidemic of homelessness in America. And these homeless people ordinarily seek shelter in the various shelters that are in existence for homeless people. And they are grossly inadequate for the number of people that are homeless. Is that right, Bob?
Grossly inadequate, and they're becoming more inadequate all the time. They say, instead of expanding the shelter facilities like they should, they're actually shutting them down.
Well, that is what I wanted to talk to you about today. I found something very disturbing, and that is that there is a dispossessory lawsuit against the Atlanta Task Force, which we know to be the largest homeless shelter that exists.
Hello?
The Atlanta Task Force. Is that the largest in Atlanta?
Oh, yes, it's by far the largest. It houses normally 500 men under normal circumstances, and when there's an emergency because of weather or cold, you know, freezing weather or a heat wave, it can house as many as 1,000, and it occasionally does. And it has a small capacity for women and children, but much smaller than for men. So it's mainly a men's shelter, and it's called an overflow shelter. When the other shelters cannot accommodate the demand, they send them to the task force, and the task force takes in whoever they can. I want to point out that for people who are mentally ill, shelters are not necessarily accessible, because with mental illness always comes disorientation and confusion. And a lot of people who are living on the streets who are mentally ill are eating out of garbage cans and dumpsters and can't even find their way into the shelters. And even
thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in today to the Bob Darby and Lynn Eaglefeather Advocates for the Homeless Mentally Ill show. That was a tape from an earlier show, July 31st, 2014, when we were discussing the projected closing of the largest homeless shelter in Atlanta, Georgia. And that is the Task Force for the Homeless. And it is in litigation right now. And we just think it's a darn shame that three homeless shelters with the task force, if it closes, that would be three homeless shelters in the Atlanta, Georgia area that are gone, in spite of the fact that this is a major metropolitan area. It is possibly the largest population in the Southeast. And rather than making new solutions for people who are impacted by mental illness, who have been impact, negatively by this economy and they're homeless. Instead of making new solutions for these people, we have business entities who are actually facilitating the closing of the last recourse for people who have lost everything. And so we think that is a symptom of the corporate government takeover of America. And we're very concerned for the people who are rendered homeless, especially those who have already lost their mental capabilities in order to provide for themselves. And I want to welcome you again. This is Human Rights Demand. My name is Mary Neal. I'm Director of Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill. Bob Darby, Lynn Eaglefeather, and I all recognize that for the mentally ill, homelessness is often a precursor to incarceration, because mentally ill people who are homeless are oftentimes arrested for vagrancy and panhandling if they don't have shelters to provide their meals. And so it just leads to a whole lot of other things. And we thank you for joining us on Human Rights Demand. You know, Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. I believe we have Bob Darby on the line with us right now. We're expecting Lynn Eaglefeather to join us also. And one of the things that we'll discuss with Lynn Eaglefeather is tasering of an 8-year-old Native American girl by South Dakota police. And they said of this little first or second grader was reasonable. It was justified. They tasered a little girl, 8 years old. She's a Native American girl, right in her chest, according to the article. And the police said their tasering of this little Native American child was justified. So we stand for the rights of all people, whether they're white, black, Native American, Asian, Latino. All people deserve human rights. They have a right to life, and they have a right to liberty. They have a right to the pursuit of happiness. Nobody is happy when their little 8-year-old child is having traumatic episodes now because she's been accosted by police and tasered. So her family has sued for that. So I want to welcome you, Bob Darby. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm having some problems with my hearing, but other than that, I can still hear. But anyway, that's another subject. I'm real happy to be back on the show, and I heard some of the previous recording that you played, and I thought it was very acceptable. And I don't have anything new to add to what's happening. I did read in the Sunday paper that there's a dispossessory notice for that. They're trying immediately to evict the task force of the homeless, but to the best of my knowledge, they haven't succeeded yet. Just last week, I heard indirectly from Anita Beatty, the director of the task force, that since the closing of the Jefferson Place Men's Shelter and the Springdale Center Shelter for the Women and Children, that more regularly the task force is housing 900 people a night, about 700 men and about 200 women and children every night. So crisis situation, and if the courts order the eviction of the task force of the homeless from that building, then up to 1,000 people, including women and children, will be deposited on the streets to add to the many thousands that are already there. So it's a desperate situation, and it's been given scant attention in the mainstream news. It's an atrocity, really. I mean, it's throwing sick people, throwing people who are sick, who are mentally ill, and who have other illnesses out on the street is an atrocity, because it's impossible for people with severe illnesses to live on the streets permanently. Like you said, if they do not die, then they will, the next place for them to go will be jail, will be incarceration. And of course, as you pointed out, incarceration is a huge business in this country, and it's getting bigger all the time. In fact, if you have any updates on the prison industrial complex and the prison as a growing big business, do you have any new information about that, Mary? Or any information,
well,
anything like that?
I'm glad you asked, Bob, because as a matter of fact, assistance to the incarcerated mentally ill is in negotiations right now with human rights attorneys. We are going to sue the United States of America for its negligence, abuse, and many wrongful deaths of the mentally ill before and after incarceration. We are going to sue on behalf of people like these who they are getting ready to evict because the shelter is on land that they perceive as being very valuable. And I was disappointed to read that Emory University Hospital is anxious to take over the land that is now occupied by the task force, the homeless shelter. Just as Emory University took over the land when the mental hospital closed here in Atlanta. So I just thought that's some information that's important to everyone, since Emory University is one of the hospitals that is being chosen to treat Ebola. The Ebola patients who were flown here from Africa were taken to Emory University Hospital for their treatment. When you're handling deadly disease like Ebola, excuse me, you like to know that it's in the hands of very socially conscious people, and Emory University is not coming across that way. I wrote an article about Emory University that I'd like for everyone to read. You know, years ago, Tuskegee University, down at Tuskegee Institute, Tuskegee University Hospital was involved in the syphilis experiments. Those were government experiments to track the progress of syphilis that were done on black farmers in Alabama. They were, I think, deliberately infecting people with syphilis, but the exposés on the Tuskegee experiments don't go so far as to say that they were deliberately infecting the farmers, but they do acknowledge that the farmers were coming to the doctors at Tuskegee Institute and they were being given placebos instead of real medication. They had penicillin. They could have cured them, but they would not. They did not. They just were tracking the course of their illness. Their babies were being born with all kinds of birth defects. They went home and infected their spouses. They spread syphilis throughout the black community down there by simply watching to see how it goes. The men were deliberately made to believe that they were getting treatment from the U.S. government, and they were not. They were being used, misused, and this didn't happen back in the 1800s. This happened from 1932 until 1972. So we already have an example of how an important university hospital can be misused by the government to spread diseases throughout a community. We have that example. And so I wanted to learn more about Emory University Hospital, since that hospital has the Ebola virus, a deadly virus that kills between 50 and 90% of the people who are exposed to it. And what I found about Emory University Hospital and the college was encouraging on one hand, but it was very alarming on another hand. I saw where the president of Emory University Hospital had written an apology to Jewish dental students for its racism toward them, its anti-Semitism. I saw where a black former medical student at Emory University Hospital had written to the school and said, well, what about me? What about how you treated black medical students? And then I saw where they have taken over or been a part of the takeover of the mental hospital in Atlanta. And we all know that as doctors, they certainly should have known what it meant to close the doors of that mental hospital. And now I read that they are a part of the conspiracy to withhold funds for the biggest homeless center in Atlanta, the task force. They were a part of the conspiracy to withhold public funds from that task force to make it viable. And now that the task force is in bad trouble financially because of these withheld funds, I read that Emory University is ready to take over that land. So again, I say to you, hospitals are not all about technology and medical know-how. It should be very important to everybody, more than ever, in view of what is possible scientifically. It should be more important to everybody that people have social consciousness and that they have a sense of morals and that they really believe and that they really act on the belief that liberty and justice and human rights belong to everybody. It's not determined by race, gender, or wealth, or health status. Don't you agree with me, Bob?
Well, I certainly do agree with that, and I don't know, you didn't mention, but I don't know whether you know it or not, but the lead story on the news today, which I saw on both PBS and the networks, is that the two Ebola patients who were at Emory University Hospital were released and pronounced as cured, both of them. And, in fact, they interviewed the doctor of the pair, a man who looked very healthy, and they claimed to have cured them, and they were released back into the general public and into their family. So apparently they were able to cure them, but I understand that the Ebola virus generally kills about half the people it infects, but I don't know what's going on with this, but I'm just adding this as an event that was announced in the news, on television news today, that those two patients were released from the Emory University Hospital. And by the way, the name of the mental hospital that was closed in 1998 and bought by Emory University was the Georgia Mental Health Institute. And at the time, I was aware of it, and I was working with a group that fed homeless people on the streets, and we almost immediately saw a spike in the number of homeless people we were serving, people who had been inpatients in the hospital that was closed, and that were released and fell through the cracks and ended up on the streets. So now they're Emory University is talking about acquiring the four-story large building directly across the street from what used to be the Crawford Long Hospital at Peachtree and Pine. It's now the Emory University Midtown Hospital. Now they're talking about acquiring the property vacated, about to be apparently, vacated by the Task Force of the Homeless, which houses, at last count, about 900 people a night, which is accommodating some of the people, a lot of the people, who were displaced in Jefferson Place in the Springdale Center for men and for women, excuse me, women and children were closed. So it's a dire situation, and it is being reported in the mainstream press, but just barely. And mainly the information that one can acquire about it is on the Internet, is often the case. But it is so important that it cannot be completely ignored by the mainstream. So, yes, I know about the connection between the CDC and presumably Emory University medical facilities and the Tuskegee experiments, which were truly horrific and genocidal after a fashion, or it was kind of in the same vein as the medical experiments that took place in the Holocaust in Germany in World War II, where they experimented on live people and with disease agents and with other really heinous experiments. The Tuskegee experiment was every bit as bad as what they did to the people in the concentration camps. They lied to people by saying they were treating them, like you said, Mary, with placebos. And just to trace the progression of the illness, and then when they died, they gave them autopsies. So they autopsied the dead bodies of the people who died from syphilis. So there's and this was reported. This was reported in the mainstream press, and to the best of my knowledge, no one was prosecuted for it. It was just reported. So now, Lord knows what's going on. You know, there's a lot, you know, we find out about things after they happen or sometimes in the process of happening, and then no heads roll. So I don't think when they close the task force for the homeless, and it looks inevitable that eventually they will, and they put 1,000 more people out on the streets, that heads will roll. I mean, it will just be property acquired by Central Atlanta Progress and their interest, and Emory University and similar corporate entities. So that's what's going on. And what about the most recent information concerning the incarceration of displaced persons, of the mentally ill, of the homeless? That is an equally and very much associated wickedness that is occurring in this society, and that in standing up for the incarcerated mentally ill is Mary Neal's primary focus. Mary, would you like to talk about that some more?
Well, thank you, Bob. As a matter of fact, we have good news regarding assistance to the incarcerated mentally ill. There's a situation right now where three mentally ill people were recently killed by police. Ezell Ford was killed by LAPD. He was a 25-year-old black man. The way witnesses tell it, he was walking down the street in Los Angeles, just like Michael Brown was walking down the street. And police stopped him. And for some reason, they told him to lie down, face down, on the pavement. Ezell Ford did that in complete compliance with the command by the police. And when Ezell Ford did lie down on the pavement, Police shot him multiple times in the back. So just like Micah Brown was a victim of overuse of force for no apparent reason, so was Ezell Ford. Also, Ferguson Police Department killed another mentally ill person. I have the video of it on my Facebook page of the actual shooting. A man he had just apparently stolen two sodas from a store, and police rolled up on him, and he may have had a small butter knife or something similar in his hand. They asked him to drop the knife, and they started shooting him, not with tasers. All of these police departments have bought tasers to use non-lethal force. Well, we know tasers are not non-lethal. They're less lethal. But nevertheless, police officers throughout the country skip using their tasers, and they prefer to shoot people, especially black people, especially anybody who's mentally ill, black, white, whatever they are, with live ammunition. So the young man in Ferguson, Missouri, was killed by police on August 19th. So that did not do anything to help calm down the public rage over Michael Brown's killing. Another situation developed in California. This is San Jose, California, Bob. A young lady, 19 years old, was killed by police when they responded, I believe, to her family's call. Families, when you call the police for your mentally ill loved ones, I hope you have a good funeral policy. I hope you have a good funeral insurance policy, because it's not at all unusual for the police you call for help to kill your loved one. So this young lady, 19 years old, in San Jose, California, it appears that her family called for help because she was talking erratic and what have you. And the police came, and she supposedly had an unplugged electric drill in her hand. Unplugged electric drill. They say they thought it was some kind of gun, and they shot her to death. So right there, just last week or so, we have had three murders of mentally ill people who were experiencing mental health crisis, likely because of loss of treatment. And so this is not anything unusual, Bob. This happens almost every week, that some mentally ill person is killed by police doing a lunacy arrest somewhere in America. And so assistance to the incarcerated mentally ill is about to launch an international lawsuit against the United States of America. And we are looking for 100 claimants who have had family members denied treatment, arrested and kept in long-term solitary confinement, which is a violation of human rights, who have had family members to be killed, who've had family members to be brutalized in prison or by police, who have had family members to be brutalized by anybody while they were homeless, because that homelessness is also evidence of governmental neglect, who've had family members to suffer long-term homelessness. That in itself is a violation against the human rights when you have people with mental disabilities who are homeless, scraping the bottom of the barrel, living out of garbage cans and handouts. That is negligence, and it's unacceptable for any member nation of the United Nations especially a member nation that is able to fund wars, is able to give out as much as millions and sometimes trillions of dollars to other countries. I do not believe that such a country as that has to leave its mentally handicapped people homeless and leave them no recourse but prison. This is happening because our decision makers, frankly, Bob, they are prison investors. And everybody who goes to jail or prison is more money in their pocket. So therefore, they want to close whatever avenue people who are homeless, mentally ill, or borderline, whatever avenue they have for support, they want to end it because they want them all in prison. Simple as that. They want them in prison. And so closing the task force is a part of the prison investors plan. We're taking this whole issue regarding the undermining of services to people with mental illness and drug and alcohol substance abuse problems, addicts, if you will. We're taking this whole thing to the United Nations in a large lawsuit against the USA. Also, I want you to know that not only are the mentally ill people themselves, not only are the drug and alcohol addicts themselves invited to join the lawsuit, but also if your family member or if you have ever been accosted, raped, burglarized, or if you had someone killed by an individual who was a drug addict or who was mentally ill, then you also can join this lawsuit because your loved one would still be here if the United States of America had not criminalized mental illness and forsaken its responsibility to provide for these people. Your loved one would still be here if the U.S. government had not withdrawn Medicare for inpatients in mental hospitals as an excuse to close down the mental hospitals and render everyone to prison where they turn around and invest it in private prisons to be able to reap billions upon billions of dollars per year. So it's all a plan. It's a larger scale than the Pennsylvania judges who were remanded to prison, one for 17 years and one for 28 years, for selling children into their business partners' juvenile private facilities. What happened to the mentally ill in the 1960s and 70s is the exact same thing, only it's on a much bigger scale. Those Pennsylvania judges didn't think of that. They were only taking something that was done in the 60s and 70s and doing it in their own community. And that is, they choked off funds to the publicly owned jail for children, juvenile facilities. They choked off the funds so that those facilities would no longer be useful. And then they started channeling children for a fee to their business partners' juvenile correctional facility. And they didn't care whether the children did something worthy of going there or not. They were getting paid per head. And they admitted it. This is nothing different than what has happened to the mentally ill. First, they choked off Medicaid as far as the insurance to help people have psychiatric treatment in mental hospitals. Then they instituted strong laws against committing a person unless they proved, usually through violence, that they were a danger to self and others, and that locked the door. So they kicked mentally ill people out of psychiatric treatment and locked the door behind them. And I think that's wrong. Many, many families think that's wrong. We know it's wrong. And so we're about to take this whole matter of mass incarceration of people with mental infirmities to the United Nations. What do you think about that, Bob?
Well, I think that, you know, you're covering the subject really well. And I keep hearing these beeps. Does that mean somebody's calling in? Do you hear the beeping?
It could. Nobody's showing up at the board. But the thing is that one of the things that my lawsuit will cover, the part that deals with my issues, will be all of this censorship. Mm. People sometimes try to call, and they don't let them in.
Oh, okay. Well, is Miss Eagle Feather on the line right now?
She was, but her call dropped.
Lynn's not on the line anymore. Lynn Eagle Feather is not on the line anymore?
She was on the line, but her call dropped.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to leave pretty soon, too. I'm having trouble with my hearing. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about before I sign off?
Well, Bob, I so much appreciate you. I want you to tell us a little bit, if you could, about the center, the international, they say, Center for Human Rights that they have built in Atlanta with around $2 million while they closed the homeless centers for the lack of almost that exact amount.
Well, that's pretty atrocious, isn't it?
The Human Rights Center.
I don't know very much about the new center. You know a lot more about it than I do. I know that it exists, and I know that they're spending money on that they arguably took away from the Jefferson Place Men's Shelter and the shelter for women also. So I don't, you know, you're more knowledgeable about Center for Human Rights. It's real ironic that they should spend all that money on the Center for Human Rights while taking away the money for the shelter for the homeless. You know, it's incredibly ugly, an incredibly ugly irony that they did that. So we're living in really ghastly, frightening times. And I think a lot of people are aware of that. They don't want to face it head on. Who does? I'd rather not deal with it either, but it's come to my attention and I can't leave it alone. Why we are developing a society that throws sick people out on the street and puts them in jail. What is that noise?
Sorry, that was my phone ringing. I turned it off there.
Oh, okay. While we are developing a society that, you know, Mr. Brown, the young man who was shot to death, he was 18 years old, I believe, and he had his hands raised and the policeman shot him 6 times. I mean, what possible justification could the policeman have for shooting an unarmed man who was trying to surrender 6 times? I mean, and then the police showed up with military vehicles on the streets to attack the crowds that were protesting the murder of Mr. Brown. I don't understand. I don't understand how such an outrageous thing could happen. What is the possible justification that the police department is giving for having murdered this man? I mean, how are they justified? They'll think of something. Well, they've had over a week to think of something, and they still haven't found any way to cover up for this crime on the part of the police. So, you know, hands up, don't shoot. And yet they shot the man 6 times. It looks like murder to me. And this is a statement of what is going on in terms of crimes against helpless people all over this country. I don't know what Mr. Brown's what was his first name? Michael Brown?
Yes.
Michael Brown. I don't know what he was accused of, allegedly taking a box of cigars from a convenience store. But I don't even know if that's true. I mean, they showed this, as I said, a character assassination video of him. But we don't know what happened. I mean, and now the whole country is just in a terrible mess. And this just highlights what's going on in terms of the attack on the helpless and the weak and the sick. And I don't know where it's going to go, but we're in a crisis, and they're pretending it's not a crisis, but it keeps on going. What do you think, Mary?
Oh, it's absolutely. And I just want to point out, Bob, that yes, it appears that Micah Brown may have stolen something in a store, but understand that the police who shot him did not know that.
Oh.
He did not even know this boy may have stolen something in a store. That's not why he shot him.
Why did he shoot him? I mean, they haven't given a reason, have they? I mean, he was walking in the road or something like that. I mean, I don't understand it at all. All I know is that a policeman shot a man, a young man who had his hands raised and was trying to surrender, shot him 6 times. And would you know any more about this? I mean, they haven't. No wonder people are turning up in the thousands on the streets in Ferguson, Missouri. If I were there, I'd be on the streets too. So,
well, I was on the street here recently, Bob. We were downtown Decatur at the old courthouse, and we had a protest on behalf of Micah Brown, who should not have been killed. And I just want to make clear to my radio audience that I am so proud of the people who I was assembled with there on the grounds of the courthouse in Atlanta. Well, this is in Decatur, Georgia, a little town very near Atlanta. I want you to know the protest here was organized by an Asian woman, and there were probably half as many Caucasians there as there were African Americans. So our protest in Decatur represented the outrage of the people, not just blacks, not just any particular group, but our protest there on the courthouse grounds represented the outrage of justice-minded people in America. And I understand that people all over the world are incensed at the murder of Michael Brown, a surrendered young man who was not stopped by police because of any store robbery. The policeman who did this murder did not even know there had been a store robbery. He simply wanted to assert his authority and his right, because it appears that police have been given a right to kill people as they see fit. And most of them who are Caucasian happen to see fit to kill black people. I want you to know while we're talking about this that a little Native American girl in South Dakota was tasered by police. Do you know how old she was? She was 8 years old. And the police said that tasering this little child in her chest was justified. Her family, of course, disagreed with that. And they have sued, but this is in Indian Country Today Media Network. And I want you to read about this little Native American girl who police accosted, a beautiful little child, 8 years old. I think that's barely second grade. She's a Rosebud Sioux girl. She was shot by a stun gun as Pierra, P-I-E-R-R-E. Police arrived on scene and were not able to obtain a paring knife the little girl was holding. Apparently, the little girl was holding a paring knife. In the days that followed, the family of the little girl reported that she was suffering from trauma. While the Piera Police Chief Bob Grandprix said the actions of the police were justified. So here we have a teenager, a black teenager, who was shot dead with live ammunition because he was jaywalking. Essentially, what he was doing wrong is jaywalking. The policeman told him to clear the street, according to a witness, and he said, all right, officer, we're doing that now. We're walking to the sidewalk. And the police, I guess he didn't say that in a slave-like way. And so the officer grabbed him by the neck, according to the witness, and was tussling with him while he's hanging on the side of the car, and the officer's got him by the neck, while the policeman was apparently reaching for his gun. He had this boy by the neck, Michael Brown. And Michael Brown broke free and started running and told his friend to run because Michael Brown recognized that this cop was crazy. This cop was dangerous. He's reaching for his gun and got Michael Brown by the neck, and he hadn't even exited his car yet. And so he and his companion, Michael Brown and his companion, broke out running. And luckily, his companion said he died behind a car. But Michael Brown said, run, man, run. And he kept running. Well, he was a clear target for that police officer who took out running behind him and shooting as he ran, according to multiple witnesses. And so I guess at some point, Michael Brown realized, I may be able to outrun this cop, but I can't outrun those bullets. And so he stopped running, and he surrendered. Hands up, man, don't shoot. And that's when the policeman had a clear target in Michael Brown, and he shot him 6 times in his raised arm and 2 bullets in his head. So we have here before you on the table today a little girl, 8 years old, who had a paring knife. I don't know what she was doing with the paring knife. The article I read in Indian country does not explain why the child had a paring knife. But these police officers, presumably grown people, could not grab that little girl and take that paring knife from her. They had to taser her in her chest. And when they did that, they traumatized that child, maybe for a little while and maybe for the rest of her life. I want you to know that not only was Michael Brown killed, but right now my total is at, I think, 13 people have been killed since Mr. Garner was killed by New York PD by choking. Let me count the bodies. We have Darius Cole Garrett. He was 21. He lived in Chicago, Illinois. He was riding his bicycle. Police said they tried to stop him. He was riding his bicycle. Police told him to stop, and then the police shot him to death. Now, the police say that he pointed a weapon at them. So whether or not Darius Cole Garrett pointed a weapon, or whether they just used one of those extra weapons that police sometimes carry for when they kill unarmed people, we don't know. He was black. The next person they killed was white. His name was John Wrinkler. He was a television show worker. He worked on a television show. I forget the name of it. He was killed out there in Los Angeles, California. He was 30 years old. Now, Mr. Wrinkler was a victim. He and another victim of an attempted kidnapping and robbery were running from the scene. Police had been called. And so when they ran from the scene, when they burst through the door because they got loose, the police just opened fire on them, and they were the victims. So John Wrinkler got killed, mistaken identity. A 30-year-old white man. The kidnapper was up in another room, and he still had one of the people he kidnapped in custody. So then the next victim was black. It was Kajimi Powell, 25 years old, of Ferguson, Missouri. He was murdered on August 19th. That's a mentally ill man who had stolen, apparently, two Cokes or two sodas. Then we have the teenage girl. They haven't released her identity, so we don't know what her race was. She was killed on August 14th. And she's the one who had the power drill not plugged up. And the police said they thought that was a gun. So we have a white man who got killed. Yes, they're killing white ones too, everybody. Dylan Taylor, he was killed in Salt Lake City, Utah on August 13th. And his situation was that police were trying to arrest him because he had an arrest warrant on violation of probation, and he didn't have any gun or any weapon. They just killed him. Then we have a black person, Dante Parker, was killed in Victorville, California on August 12th. We have another black person, Ezell Ford. He got killed on August 11th in Los Angeles, California. He was mentally ill. The man I told you they made lie down, face down on the pavement and shot him in the back. And by the way, when his mother came to the scene, Bob, do you know what the police did?
What?
They got out their billy clubs at her. No, for the mother of the man they had just killed. They got out their billy clubs and threatened her. Then we have the black young man who was killed, unarmed, Michael Brown. And we also have another black unarmed man killed, John Crawford in Beaver Creek, Ohio. Then we have a Latino who was killed, Omar Abrego. He was killed by LAPD. He was stopped at a traffic. They stopped him in traffic and just opened fire on him, just killed him. He was unarmed. It was a traffic stop. And then we have Eric Garner, who was killed on Staten Island, New York by NYPD. And prosecution is underway in the Eric Garner case. The DA decided to go ahead and take that abusive police officer before the grand jury because that's the murder that kicked off this summer of police terror. He was killed July 17th. And behind his death came a whole slew of murders. And so altogether, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So we've had 11. Now, murders of citizens since July 17th. And I want you to know that I read estimates that say American citizens have suffered 5,000 deaths by police since 9/11. That's when our civil rights were taken away. 9/11. So since 9/11, American citizens have suffered 5,000 deaths by police. Go ahead, Bob. Tell us what you think about this.
Well, I think that we're in an unspoken domestic crisis. There are things going on all over the world that are certainly in crisis with the massacres in Gaza and the situation in Iraq and Syria and the situation in Ukraine. I mean, the whole world is embroiled in numerous crises, and the United States is having its own crisis with police powers running unchecked and committing atrocities and innocent and sick people being injured. So we're living in a time of great peril, and I think that millions of people are beginning to find out about that. If I had known about the demonstration in Decatur, I almost certainly would have gone. I didn't hear about it. But there are demonstrations all over the United States going on concerning the domestic crises we have of police departments running amok and killing people and locking people up without any kind of good reason and without due process. So we're living right now in a police state, and it's rapidly coming to be publicly recognized as such. And that's what I think is going on. We're in a time of crisis, and it's almost certainly going to get worse before people wake up and do something about it. That's my view. And listen, I need to get off the line. But it was good being on the program, and I've been on it for almost an hour, and I need to leave. So I'll say goodbye to you, Mary, and to anyone who calls in, please do, and speak your mind. Is that okay, Mary?
Absolutely, Bob Darby. And as always, we so much appreciate you and the information you bring to the people and sacrificing your time to come online and speak to the people on behalf of the homeless, mentally ill. God bless
well,
you, and you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
All right. That was Bob Darby, everyone. He's an advocate for the homeless, mentally ill. Now, I'm going to call Lynn Eaglefeather because she called while we were on the line with Bob Darby, and I'm going to see if we're able to get her because she wanted to address the tasering of the Native American girl in Piera, South Dakota. That's overuse of power, as far as I'm concerned. And it's child abuse also. So the Native American little girl, 8 years old, a baby, not just a teenager, but an actual baby, was tasered by police. And they call that justified. So I'm going to see if I can get Ms. Lillian Eaglefeather on the line now. And if not, I want you to know that you can call in and discuss any events at all that you want to, anything having to do with human and civil rights. Because that's what's at issue here. Whether or not Americans have human rights. I think we should have human rights, but unless you have your rights protected, you may as well not have them. So we're going to take some of these issues to the United Nations. And again, I ask you, if you know anyone or if you are a person who has mental illness and who was wrongly denied treatment, if you were told that you got to do a crime first to get treatment, that's wrong.
Blog Talk Radio.
We're dialing
Welcome to
now.
Blog Talk Radio. If you desire to speak to the host, please press 1 at any time, and the host will be notified that there is a caller in queue. Otherwise, please hold and you will be able to listen to the show. Love.
Hi, this is Mary Neal rejoining you. It appears that somebody who called in, when they called in, they knew it. And it was I don't know if you will. There are two phone numbers on the board, and when these individuals called, the whole system started with the noise punishment because of the protest regarding Michael Brown. I read to you a list of individuals who've been killed by police because a number of people think that it's what happened to Michael Brown is an isolated incident, and it's not an isolated incident. It is common. It is ordinary. Now, I wanted to call one of our hosts and see was she available to talk about the things that are happening. And when I went to call her, two numbers came through. And when these two numbers came through, as though they were calling the radio station, the noise started. And this has been very horrific noise. And it's like the noise that they played to punish the people in Ferguson for protesting the Michael Brown murder. I'm calling Lillian Eaglefeather right now to see if she's available to speak to us. She was on air. She was, I'm sorry, on the radio show. But before I could pick up on her call, it was terminated. So I don't know whether she did that or whether it was Cointelpro. Let's call her now. Lillian Eaglefeather wanted to speak about the Native American child, a little girl aged 8 years old, that was tasered. She was tasered by Pierra, South Dakota police.
Hi, you know who you've reached. Leave a message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Okay, Lillian Eaglefeather has left the phone area. And I'm going to see if these two numbers that are on the board are people calling in to speak or whether these are just phone numbers that were used to send the noise punishment. Okay. And now we have, I think, more noise punishment at this number. Wow. Well, now that's a first for me. They have the capacity. I like to write down their censorship methods. They have the capacity to send people to call your number and make this noise. And when they do that, then, all conversation is impossible. Well, I'm going to go ahead and get rid of these callers because of your live people. I'm sorry. Wow. Isn't that something? That is really amazing. You know, technology has outdistanced morals in America. Technology has greatly outdistanced morality. We don't seem to have respect for each other as we should, but it's very unfortunate that we don't. And we don't seem to be operating under people who have much respect for citizens' rights either. So we will see how much these people respect human rights. We will see, because we are going to See, well, wait a minute. I back that up. We already know that they don't have much respect for human rights, but we're going to see how much respect they have for the United Nations and for the Declaration of Human Rights. We haven't seen evidence where human rights are respected much in the United States of America, but I could be wrong. Tell me your experience. The telephone number here is 347-857-3293. We have another 30 minutes or so to be on the air, and so I invite you to tell me about your observations, your opinions, and your experience regarding respect for human rights, respect for civil rights in the United States of America. What have you seen? What have you heard? How have you been treated? I was telling you about this little girl who's a Rosebud Sioux girl, 8 years old, on October in October 2013. This 8-year-old child was shot by a stun gun when Pierre police arrived on the scene and were not able to obtain a paring knife that the little girl was holding. In the days that followed, the family of the little girl reported that she was suffering from trauma, while the Pierre police chief, Bob Grandprix, said the actions of the police were justified. I think the actions he's speaking of equate to child abuse, and he said they were justified. Since the incident, family members have secured the use of Dana Hanna and Patrick Duffy as attorneys in the South Dakota area, and the tribe has spoken out against the incident. The Pierre police, after releasing initial findings, will no longer offer comment on the matter after inquiries by ICTMN. Rose Stenstorm, the grandmother of the little girl and a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Council, says she was upset that her little granddaughter was a delightful and talkative little girl who some media outlets made out to be a monster. My granddaughter is really just a friendly little girl, said Stenstrom. She talks a lot because she likes to talk. You could change her mind really easily. I have been around her. She's not anywhere near what people describe her as being. They made her out to be a little monster, and she is not. Well, I want you Native Americans to know that that's typical. Blame the victim. Blame the victim. This little girl was tasered by big, strong police officers. And so now, this grandmother is complaining that the media, not the police, the media, made her granddaughter out to be a monster. Don't be surprised at that. The media is every bit a big part of the oppression of minority people. The media is a great big part of backing up the police, backing up the government, and anything they decide to do. Also, keeping secret whatever they tell the media to keep secret. All of that is usual and ordinary. For this little child to be made out to be a monster because police tasered her, that's typical. And so Stenstrom, who's her grandmother and who's on the tribal council, said the response to the original situation was not handled with any sort of professionalism. 4 police officers responded to this, to a little girl who stands maybe 4 feet tall. All you have to do is grab her arm and correct the situation. I feel that these guys must not have been in their right mind. At that age, children are very easily talked into changing their minds. I find it ridiculous because I just don't see how this could happen. She's talking about her little 8-year-old granddaughter who was tasered by police, who say there was no way to bring this situation under control except by tasering a little baby girl in her chest. And the article has more information on the public's reaction to this, the Native Americans' reaction to this, and I would like for you to go to Indian Country Today Media Network and read the article about the 8-year-old Native American child who was tasered by South Dakota police. The name of the article is South Dakota Police Say Tasing 8-year-old Native Girl Was Justified. The Family Sues. This article was written by Benson Schilling on August 19, 2014. Also on August 19, 2014, I want you to know that 2 more Americans were killed. John Winkler in Los Angeles, California by LAPD, and Kajimi Powell, 25 years old, of Ferguson, Missouri. I've told you about Mr. Powell, who allegedly stole 2 sodas. He's mentally ill. He refuses to give up his 2 sodas, and police shot him to death. He allegedly had a little knife. And this little girl allegedly had a little paring knife. We thank you, South Dakota police, for not killing her. You tased her. You could have tased Mr. Powell also instead of killing him. John Winkler was a victim who was fleeing a scene where he had been kidnapped. He and another victim were clearing the building, running, and police didn't know the situation, and of course, they didn't bother to stop and ask. They just opened fire on them because they were fleeing the scene. And they were the victims. They were fleeing from a scene where they had been, as I understand it, accosted and robbed. Police had been called, and they had gotten away from the man, and they were fleeing, and the police shot them. So that also happened on August 19th. We have a lot going on all the time. I think this is Miss Lillian Eaglefeather. Hello there, Lillian. How are you?
Hi, Mary. I'm doing fine. I'm out shopping, but I will try to call earlier. How are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful, Lillian. Guess what we have going on here at Human Rights Demand?
What?
2 people called, and when I opened up their lines, the radio channel was attacked with noise, and it sounded very much like that noise that they attacked the protesters with at the Michael Brown protest. You know, the police have these great big noisemakers that they can turn to whatever position they want. If they want to, they can burst your eardrums with them. But I don't think that happened to anyone at the Michael Brown protest. I didn't read about anyone getting their eardrums burst, but they did turn the noisemakers up. Well, they just did it to Human Rights Demand. They just did it to us. Yeah. So let me let you go ahead with your presentation, Lillian. You have 25 minutes to talk to us about whatever you see fit.
Okay. Well, my name is Lynn Eaglefeather. I am from the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, and I am calling in today on the Human Rights Demand on this little 8-year-old girl that got tased by the police. It is very wrong. She was only 70 pounds. 4 police officers were around her at the time. And if that happened to one of my granddaughters, I don't know what I would do. I had, you know, a 70-year-old little girl against 4 grown adults. Come on now. What is wrong with these police nowadays? And now I have a friend, that very dear friend, that called me for last night That last night she called me and told me that her cousin, and I posted it to my Facebook page. You can see it on Lynn Eagle Feather. She said that her cousin was handcuffed and he got tased 17 times while he was down on the ground. It's on YouTube. He got tased 17 times by the police, by one policewoman. She's a non-native, and stood over him and tased him and tased him and tased him. He is now in the hospital. That happened Friday. He is still in the hospital, and my cousin, my friend said that her cousin is not the same anymore. He's not going to be the same because of this tasing incident. Now, this police brutality has got to stop, and especially with a young child like that. And I have a granddaughter here. Her name is Aaliyah. Say hi, Aaliyah.
Hi.
Hi.
Tell them what you think about the little girl getting tased.
I would say that it's wrong, and I would feel so sad if my sisters got tased like that.
Well, thank you, Aaliyah.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
And tell us how old you are.
I'm 11 years old.
Well, nice to meet you, Aaliyah.
Nice to meet you, too.
So we were stepping in the bathroom at the store. We're in the store, and I wanted to call and just comment. And there's a police protest downtown. I want to go attend here in Denver against the police brutality at 5:45 in Denver, Colorado, in front of the jail. So that's probably where I'm going to be headed, and I'm probably will take some pictures and post them to my Facebook page because there's a lot of police brutality going on here in Denver, Colorado. A man just got awarded $3.4 million for being beat by the police and allowing other inmates to beat him. But the underlying fact was that the officers allowed him to do that because he was raping children. And that wasn't, you know, that couldn't be brought up in the case. I know that he can't bring other things into the case. But now this man is a millionaire for getting beat by the police. And I've seen numerous posts by David Martinez on the Facebook. A girl got tased in the head. She was 14 years old, running from the policeman, and she got tased in her skull, had to have staples and have her hair shaved off. So these policemen have got to stop doing what they're doing. They, you know, as Michael Brown, God rest his soul, you know, got shot in the top of the head. You know, he had to have been down for them to shoot him like that. And you know, I wish more people could understand that these policemen and policewomen are trained to be, they're supposed to serve and protect, but they're not serving and protecting us as citizens. We are anymore, and, you know, people are being more afraid of them than they should be protected by them, and something needs to be done. Obama needs to step up. These people need to go get these. The policemen need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of what the crimes that they do, and especially if it's on camera. There have been numerous killings. You know, like your brother Mary, and my cousin. I also have another cousin. His name was Benjamin David Whiteshield. He got killed in Clinton, Oklahoma. He got tased he got shot about four times, I think my cousin said. He was driven to the hospital in Clinton, Oklahoma last year or two years ago, within that time frame. And he was asking for mental help. So his aunt and his grandmother drove him to the hospital to receive help. He was having hallucinations. He had just lost his father the year before. And so they were reaching out for help for him. The hospital was right next to the police station. And since he was a big man, the aunt went to the police station instead of going just straight into the hospital and asked for help. And the police came out and he's such a big man that they were afraid of him, and he was unarmed. They found no drugs or alcohol in his system. He just needed mental help, and he got murdered by the police also. I forgot to, my cousin asked me to mention that also because she knows what I do, get on your shows about the police brutality. So there's another incident right there.
Excuse me? Can I ask you a question? What year was that that your cousin was murdered by police?
I think it's been 2 years. I wrote it down at home, and I was going to read it off, but I can't remember, but his name is Benjamin David Whitefield. And he was killed in Clinton, Oklahoma. And I think it's been 2 years, if not a year, because my cousin is still mourning over the loss of her son.
Well, did your family sue?
My cousin was not in his life, so he had a stepmother, and he was raised by his family. So I'm not sure if what's going on, but my cousin is very upset about the whole thing, that I don't think they did anything. And I think, I don't know what the statute of limitations are, because I told my cousin that she should do something about it also.
Well, you know, the statute of limitations or personal injury is only 1 year in Tennessee, and it's 2 years in Georgia. So what I'd like for you to do is try to find out how long your cousin has been dead so that we can try to help them find a good wrongful death attorney.
Okay. I will do that when I get home.
If your cousin was mentally ill, he qualifies to come under our lawsuit. You know, we have a lawsuit that we're getting ready to file with the United Nations about human rights abuses. But I think that if you are within the time frame, your family should pursue wrongful death action through the American courts.
Okay.
So I want you to pursue that because I want all of my people to do what's best for them. You know that about me. So I'm thinking that if you have never approached a lawyer and never filed wrongful death lawsuit in America, I'm thinking that you need to do that within the time frame set by law.
Mm-hmm.
I will let my cousin know that, and I will also find out the date, Mary, and I will give you a call later on this evening.
Want you to know, and I want the audience to know, that everyone is welcome to call me directly. My telephone number is open to the public. It should be on top of every article I wrote, and it is 678-531-0262. That number again is 678-531-0262. Unfortunately, like you heard the censorship today, when they had the noise machine turned on, us here at Human Rights Demand, I'm very censored, and I may or may not get your phone call. But you can also email me at Mary, M-A-R-Y, Love, L-O-V-E-S, Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, @gmail.com. That's Mary Love Justice @gmail.com. And that's also in the top margin of all my articles. And ordinarily, it's also in the signature block. Thank you so much, Lynn Eagle Feather, for, you know, sacrificing part of the time, you and your granddaughter's shopping trip. Call and talk to us about the little girl from the old zoo. And that's your time at business.
Okay, Mary.
And I appreciate you informing us your cousin who went to seek for medical treatment and the police killed him right there at the clinic. It was that where they killed him, right there at the clinic?
Yes, right in front.
So did they tell him they were not going to treat him or they would have?
I have no idea of the situation. I wanted to know if we could pull it up on the internet because my cousin has the picture. It was on the front page of the paper of the Clinton, Oklahoma newspaper. So I could ask him.
Do you have that on your Facebook page too?
No, but I will get a picture of it and have and put it up. I will try to look into this more. Okay.
Please do that for us, Lynn. Everybody, this is Lynn Eaglefeather, and you can find her on Facebook under the name Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Marie, M-A-R-I-E, Eagle, E-A-G-L-E, Feather, F-E-A-T-H-E-R, and put a space between each word, Lynn Marie Eaglefeather. She's an advocate for human rights, and she's a host here at Human Rights Demand every Thursday. And I thank you, Lynn. I know that you and your little granddaughter may need to get back to shopping, but we appreciate your calling so much.
Okay. Well, we just wanted to say thank you. And Leah wants to say thank you also.
Thank you.
Thank you, sweetheart. I appreciate you.
We're both listening with the headphones on, and we're in the bathroom, so she's listening to everything you're saying also, Mary.
Well, wonderful. I am so glad you are. Lynn Eaglefeather, I want you to know, and please let your family know, please let the Native Americans know that the United States of America has done such grievous violations against the human rights of people with mental illness and substance abuse problems, that is to say, people who are addicts for alcohol and drugs, as well as the mentally ill, that we are, have now secured human rights attorneys. And we are going to sue the USA in international court for its violations of the rights of persons, that's Americans with mental disabilities. And we're getting ready to file that suit. And anyone who wants to be a party to that lawsuit should try to get in touch with me. Now, they don't want you to get in touch with me, but you're going to have much to do it. So don't get anxious if you have trouble getting through. We've got to get a dedicated phone line so that everybody can call in who wants to be a part of this legal action. And we're going to do that. So you will have a better way to call. Right now, you can use my home phone number, and that's 678-531-0262. You can also call in to any of our shows here at Human Rights Demand, and let us know that you want to be one of the litigants in the lawsuit against the USA for violating the human rights of people who are mentally ill and people who have substance abuse habits. This not only goes for the mentally ill and the substance abusers, but it also goes for their victims. If you were raped, robbed, burglarized, or if you had a relative who was killed by someone who was denied psychiatric treatment, someone who was denied drug rehab treatment, and they ended up hurting you or hurting anyone that you know, then that still is because their human rights were violated and they were denied treatment. So you also have a right to join in this lawsuit if you were ever raped, robbed, assaulted, brutalized, or you had a relative who was killed by someone because that person was mentally ill. So this is going to be a big legal action. I was just talking to the international human rights attorney about it today. We expect at this point, and this is an expectation, to have the cases ready to go in the complaint to the United Nations by spring 2015. So we're going to include at least 100 people who were denied treatment and mistreated in solitary confinement long-term, beaten, robbed, raped, brutalized, or killed. And it was due to mental illness, whether you are the person who was mentally ill or whether you are the person who was hurt by someone who was mentally ill, that does not matter. We want to hear from you because this issue is going to the United Nations. At this point, we feel that mentally ill people are deliberately mistreated, they're deliberately denied treatment until they commit a crime that's worthy of incarceration. And this is done because, unfortunately, most of the decision makers in the United States are prison investors. And they deliberately wait until someone is has done something. They say, we have to wait until you prove through crime that you are a danger to self or others. So they deliberately wait for crimes before they help people who are drug addicts or mentally ill. And I think that's wrong. What do you think about that, Lynn?
I think it's very wrong. I will get in touch with my cousin, and I have also been brutalized by the police when I first came here to Denver, and I have a big story on that one also. So I will get back to you, and I want to thank you for letting me be on the show today, and my granddaughter Aaliyah also, because I'm trying to teach them what I'm doing and the brutality and teach them about these things also. I'm passing it on to them so they will understand. So I want to thank you very much for letting me be on the show, and we've got to get back out there to go finish doing our shopping, Mary. And thank you so much, and I'll talk to you on the next show. And I will
absolutely
be in touch.
And we look forward to joining us next Thursday, if not before then. You know, all of our radio listening audience are welcome to join us today. Tell them to call in for granddaughter. They're out doing their back-to-school shopping. And she's so dedicated to human rights that in the middle of her shopping, she stopped to call in and share information with us from Indian country, where an 8-year-old girl was tasered by Pierre, South Dakota police, because she had a paring knife, and they call that justified. Everything the police do, they call it justified. And because we have such a weak estimate of investors, they don't usually prosecute any police. As a matter of fact, they don't usually instigate any of the police murders. And even when they do, prosecution of the police that actually did the crime is very seldom done. So we protest that. We want people to high standard of when the law says that we, the people of the United States of America, have a right to life. And I believe that because the Constitution is something after the Bible. God says we have a right to life. God said it, I believe it, and that ends it. And this ends our show today. Thank you for joining us every day on Human Rights Demand. Most of the time we're on air by 3:00. We were later getting on air today, and we had our noise to interrupt our protest against violations of Americans' human rights. You heard that, not unlike what happened to the people of Ferguson, Missouri, who were protesting the murder of Michael Moon. Police turned on the noise real high to punish their eardrums for daring to stand up for human rights. And today, I want to let you know, you heard the same thing happen on Human Rights Demand. God bless you. Come again tomorrow night at 6:30 for the Jenny Strozier Keeping It Real show. Jenny Strozier is a man who was released from the Georgia prison system after 46 years as a Georgia prisoner. He's not bitter. He's very glad to be free. And he is here to teach people how to avoid recidivism and teach children how to avoid incarceration. Those are his two main points. And so I ask you to join us tomorrow night, that's Friday night, at 6:30 p.m. for the Jenny Strozier Keeping It Real show. Again, this is Mary Neal on Human Rights Demand. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. So we're here to make a human rights demand on your behalf and on behalf of all our neighbors. God bless you and good night.